You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. When you look at nonviolent movements from the past, led by people with familiar names like Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and many more you haven't heard of, and addressing everything from civil rights to women's suffrage to ending wars, it seems in retrospect that these nonviolent movements always had the moral high ground, and they always won eventually. But when you are living inside of, when you are living through what eventually will become history, it's not so clear. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians seems intractable for many reasons, political and structural and emotional. But there are people engaging in nonviolence and using some of the tools developed by people like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, and also many new ones, and they're keeping at it, even though it's an uphill struggle. We're going to be talking today to two men who are working for peace, Palestinian Suleiman Khatib and Israeli Chen Alon. They are co-founders of a group called Combatants for Peace, which is made up of Israeli and Palestinian ex-fighters. And for this work, their group was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. They are featured in the documentary Disturbing the Peace. This film will be screened on Sunday, February 18th, here in Santa Fe at 4 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Noga Harpas and Raed Al-Hadar, an Israeli and a Palestinian speaker, will also be at the event. I'd like to welcome now Suleiman Khatib and Chen Alon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Chen, your grandfather was a Zionist who left Poland in the 1930s and emigrated to Palestine. His entire extended family died in the Holocaust. What did this story mean to you when you were young?
I think the story meant to me like all the stories of my generation. I'm a third generation. My father grew up in Israel with the understanding that he got from his parents that, by the way, both of them lost all their families, that Zionism saved their lives. Because they were Zionist in Poland and they were suffering from anti-Semitism, they left Poland and they immigrated to Palestine or to Zion or to Israel. It's the same land for all of us, but different names. So my father grew up with the understanding that Zionism saved his family. And the meaning in Israel, in the education system and in families, in the 50s, in the 60s, and in the 70s and the 80s, where I grew up, is that Zionism means a shelter for the Jewish people, and shelter means the Israeli army, the IDF. It's the only force and the only thing that can protect us.
Suleiman Khatib, you got involved in the resistance against the Israeli occupation when you were a teenager. What did you see? What was your life like that pushed you in that direction?
Thanks for having us with you now. Simply, I grew up around the Jerusalem area, where I also carry the narrative of our people and the land where we grew up. I grew up to be a person that care about public issues, about the land, about the trees, and about the life of our people. And I understand more my contribution to protect our land is by joining the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli occupation. And when I was 13, 14, I saw growing of settlements and changing of the life and the cultural and the economical life of my community around Jerusalem. And of course, I seen, you know, like Israeli soldiers crossing in Jerusalem streets and in my village also, and the annexation of some of the land of my village and the space that I used to play with the kids from my village. So many things like have been around me, you know, also in the media and in the surrounding environment.
Chen, what did you learn about Palestinian people when you were young?
Frankly, nothing. I mean, nobody used the word Palestinians when I grew up, only Arabs. There is one kind of Arabs around us in Israel and in Arab states. We didn't hear the word Palestinians. We knew that Arabs are surrounding Israel and they all want to kill us, to throw us to the sea. I didn't know personally even one Arab person until I got to the army, except from one old guy who worked with my father. His name was Hassan, and I knew him as a nice uncle, but nobody was referring to the fact that he was a Palestinian or an Arab.
Did you have stereotypes about them? You didn't know them personally. Was there fear?
Yes, of course. I mean, I remember myself, like, you know, when we heard Arabic somewhere in Jerusalem or in trips to the West Bank, like to Hebron, or so listening to the language is kind of frightening, or crossing an Arab city and hearing the mosques and so on, this is something that is scary, sometimes threatening.
Did you know you were on occupied land when you were young?
Not really. Actually, until the 1987, the first intifada, the first Palestinian uprising, nobody talked about it. Nobody even referred to the West Bank and Gaza as occupied territories. There were different names for these areas, for these territories. There weren't a lot of uprising there, you know, not popular uprising. There were what we called, used to call in the 60s and 70s and 80s, terror. And it was not never being connected and related to the occupation. It was just, as I said, general Arab world who's trying to throw us to the sea. That was the reference.
You went into the army as a young man. What was that experience like for you? What were you commanded to do? And how did you begin to question what you were doing?
First of all, I waited to serve in the army. I mean, all my, you know, my father was a combatant soldier before I was born. And he fought in 1967 in the Six Days War, in the early 70s in the Exhaustion War, and in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. So when he came back from Yom Kippur, you know, it was the last war he fought. And I grew up with this kind of dream to follow his footsteps and to join the army, to become a combatant soldier, to defend the only shelter that the Jewish people have. So that's this is something in the background that one should understand, that I was waiting to join the army. But I had an image of myself, you know, keeping Arab armies invading Israel, the state of Israel, like the myth of 1973. But I joined the army in 1987, and I immediately joined the army with the first intifada. So all my first year in the army was actually police activities and chasing after children who were throwing stones and mass demonstrations and invading houses and imposing curfews and doing a lot of very, very intensive and violent work with the civilian population. And that was kind of a crack that I had this dream to defend my country, and I realized that I'm beating and chasing and invading children's houses and rooms and arresting children and actually fighting children and youth instead of protecting my homeland.
And so that was how you began to question what was going on?
In a way, yeah. I mean, I believe I questioned it before, theoretically, but this is something that, you know, every citizen has his own or her own opinions about what's the political horizon and so on, and ideology. But the facts on the ground that I'm a patriot, want to become a combatant soldier and later on an officer, that I really want to be part of the army that is the only security, and the reality of actually imposing or violating human rights on a daily basis was striking for me, was shocking. Day by day, you realize that something is wrong here with the goal and the mission and the dream and the vision and the actual activity, which is actually oppressing with not a good reason, not good enough reason.
Suleiman, you were locked in an Israeli prison for a decade, and it was a brutal prison where prisoners were stripped naked and they were beaten and tear gas was sprayed into your cells all the time. You went through changes there that really set your life direction. Talk about that period in your life and what happened.
Well, as you mentioned, I spent my teenager time behind the bars in jail together with thousands of Palestinian prisoners. And this is one of the faces of the life of Palestinians under the military occupation. And for me, I joined different nonviolence action inside the jail. The political prisoners, we were very organized. inside jail in order to keep our spirit strong. As we used to say, they can jail our bodies, they can jail our souls. So out of this philosophy and the contribution of the struggle, we used to do a lot of cultural activities inside the jail, which was basically illegal by the law. So we used to do like secret sessions to learn history and to learn about other revolutions in history and other conflicts. So for me, I used the time to learn also English and Hebrew, and I practiced with other prisoners, mainly food hunger strikes that we did a few times. When I was 15, we did 10 days of food hunger strike. And the last food hunger strike that I joined with other thousands of prisoners, 4,000 prisoners, was for 17 days in order to improve the daily life and the conditions in jail. And that taught me there is another way, and that nonviolence is a harder choice, but it's wise and deeper, and it can achieve change. And I know this discussion is very challenging even today, to convince people that nonviolence work. But I learned this practically in jail. Of course, I learned about Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Nelson Mandela, that he was in jail. He was very inspiring leader for the Palestinian prisoners, for many of the Palestinian prisoners. So through the jail time, I also passed through years on journey of transformation. Started maybe more from the practical point, as maybe Khin mentioned that, you know, as ex-combatants, we practice violence directly in our hands, and we reach the point that there is no military solution for our conflict. And then for me, this became an ideology of nonviolence, and that nonviolence is the way, and maybe the only way actually, for me to achieve our dignity and freedom. And this is like a long, long journey. As I said, I'm actually working on a book with a friend of mine. Actually, she lives in San Francisco, to explain all of that in more details in a book. And that we, you know, like even if you spend a lot of time in your jail, and, you know, my family still live in a village in Area C near Jerusalem, where access to my family property land became a challenge because it's behind the separation wall. And there are many other suffering that we pass through every day, like the checkpoint and the whole military system. But for me, I remain optimistic, even in the jail time. You know what we say in our culture here, like the sun will rise again tomorrow, and I see life happening and the vision of creating a different reality here together for us, by saying that for both people, Jewish and Palestinian, that connected to this land. And this is very important to create this third narrative, because what you asked us before at the beginning was, really, how did we grow up in a total separate narrative that doesn't see any space for the other narrative? So what we try to do is to create this space that our narratives can coexist and live in the same space of land.
How did the two of you meet?
Basically, what you saw in the movie, Disturbing the Peace, it's a lot of the truth, actually. But I just want to say this was a long, long process and journey. We had almost a one-year meeting for the founders of Combatants for Peace that included ex-Palestinian prisoners, activists, and ex-Israeli high-rank officers from the Israeli army that refused to stay in the army. And that was during, to put the things in the context, was during the second Intifada. So that was not easy to meet what we call the enemy, you know. It's really challenging, was really challenging. And I knew about the initiative from a friend from Bethlehem, where basically the city connected to Jesus and peace. And I came with open heart to meet a new alliances. And this was a really challenging, and we have a lot of psychological barriers and memories and all that. So this took a long time until we formed kind of a personal connection to know each other. And actually, Khin and me were the first like two combatants that we shared our personal story with 50 Palestinian Israeli ex-combatants. This was a big challenge because this was new, to know each other and to trust each other. So building this trust took a lot of time. So after like 11 years now, we are talking as close friends and the family. We know each other very well, and we know the family. And we feel together and alliance in our struggle for freedom and justice. But this is really long, long way to go. That's very important for me to mention.
Yeah, yeah. Chen, talk about what that process was like for you. I mean, people in this film called Disturbing the Peace, the film talks about how difficult it was to both establish trust and tell your own stories. Because, I mean, what if you, a soldier, had done what you did in a village where one of the people you were looking at now lived? What if you had bulldozed the house of somebody's family? And on the other side, likewise, what was that process like? How did you go through that? What did it feel like?
Sully mentioned the very first public meeting that we had, that Sully and I had the honor to tell the open stories. That encounter, which is like, you know, less than a mile from El Khader, a village, a Palestinian village in which I demolished a house just 4 years earlier. So I was actually, you know, I was so used to tell my personal stories to Israelis that I was describing the military activities like in an automatic mode for Israelis, you know, saying we were imposing curfew, we were demolishing houses and so on. And then I realized that I'm less than a mile away from where I demolished the house with my unit. And I realized that somebody here in the room might be from that village, you know, that I might tell the story and they will remember that day, that night that we demolished the house. And that was the first time that I realized that it's not only telling my story, it's not only sharing the information with people, but it's actually a practice of taking responsibility. You know, I was not asking for forgiveness. I was not captured in guilt feelings. It was like in the Truth and Reconciliation Committees in South Africa, saying, this is the truth. This is what I did. I'm not blaming anyone. I'm not talking about guilt feelings. I'm taking responsibility of who I was. And in order to know who I am today, you know, someone who refused to be part of the violence, who refused to serve in the army, who was sentenced to jail for that, this is my way to take responsibility, to say no to my army, to say no to violence, and to say yes to Palestinian partners.
How did your, both of you, your friends and family and neighbors respond to the work that you were doing, the nonviolent path?
The path that we are taking is, we know this is not the easiest path in life, personally and as a group. Definitely, once you take a new direction that more included what's supposed to be your enemy, this will bring definitely like a criticism from our own communities, of course. So at the beginning, it was more scary and risky, actually, to meet and to talk to each other and to be in public places together. But I feel that through the years, we gain trust of many people and of ourselves and of our community, which is the, I mean to say, the activist community that include Palestinian and Israelis alike, that we act together and we work together. And this give us strength in, and it's really empowering, though we are aware of, like, you know, the whole thing of imbalance here. And it goes ups and downs, you know, like when situation goes tough and tension, as you've seen in the film, for example, during Gaza war, or even these days, nowadays, while we are talking now, I'm talking Ramallah, I'm sitting in Ramallah in my home, Chen in Tel Aviv, and definitely there is a lot of violence in the area, like nowadays, basically, at this moment. There's like a lot of violence, as you can see in the news. So it's really not easy for us to be seen by some of our peoples as traitors. That's really a hard thing to do. But I personally believe what we do is out of love to our cause, our homeland, and our peoples, and for our humanity. And this deserves sacrificing and getting criticized, you know, even maybe more than that, which could happen, you know, no safety at all for somebody that not following the mainstream ideas. Obviously, our ideas are not a mainstream thing, not for the Israelis, not for the Palestinians. But I believe that we carry a model, one of the only models I see for the future and for the vision and for hope for our peoples. So I'm fine with different opinions around us, you know, and it's very challenging, but we had our own space, and we create a trust with many other organizations, with many other people. We are not alone. We work together with alliances, with different organizations from both sides. And the last example we had, we did like the Samoa Freedom Camp in summer with hundreds of Palestinians and Israelis and actually internationals. That was widely covered in the media, both in Hebrew and Arabic and English as well, actually. So we became part of the whole thing, you know, but a positive part to that, try to make real change for our people.
What about you, Chen? How did your family, your fellow soldiers and friends respond to your work in nonviolence?
As Suli mentioned, I mean, this is quite hard to describe after 11 or 12 years because it's a very long journey. And today I consider Suli as my, you know, when you say your immediate surroundings, 12 years ago, it was only Jewish people, friends, and so on. And today I can say that some of my best friends are not Jewish anymore. And this is due to Combatants for Peace. I mean, the people I trust the most now are not only from my immediate surroundings. So it's difficult for me to say, but I remember very clear when I got to this journey, I didn't know Palestinians at all. And when I started this journey, when I refused to serve in the army in 2002, people were very surprised around me, my family. And I remember my mother, I came to tell my parents that I'm going to do this and it's going to be tomorrow in the media, in the newspapers, because it was really a earthquake as the media defined it. So I came to tell my parents that they would be ready, that their son is a traitor in the front page of the newspaper. And the first question that my mother asked me was, isn't it dangerous for you? And it was the first time she asked me this question. You know, I was under fire many times and I was in really severe, dangerous threat. And only when it was about being shamed by my people, she asked if it's dangerous for me. And I remember a lot of friends from the army that said, we do not agree with you, but we know you. So we know that it comes from an honest place. We know that it comes from a place inside you that you believe that you have the responsibility to save Israel from the occupation, to save ourselves. But a lot of people were really, didn't understand, and some of them were really hostile. Not only to me, but sometimes to my wife, to my parents, and to my family.
From the outside, it looks like a form of madness, at least to me. I mean, you have continual cycles of violence and revenge. Each side feels like the victim. Each side calls the other side the perpetrator. You have this sort of ineffectual theater of peace talks and diplomacy, none of which goes anywhere. Underneath it all, you have this occupation of land that continues to the point where it's really compromising any chance for a two-state solution because there's not enough Palestinian land left to form a coherent state. We see it all unfolding. What do you think it will take to break this cycle, both in terms of attitude shifts, which the two of you are obviously living and modeling for others, and also structural solutions?
So first of all, I think you are insulting theater by comparing what is happening here and the politicians. This is not theater. This is cynicism. You know, a theater has nothing to do with cynicism. It's only theater is in its best is a real thing. It's a truthful thing. And here what we see that the peace process, quote unquote, is a cynical process, you know, that both sides are not really coming to this process with clean hands and with honesty and so on. Because the solution is there. I mean, it doesn't matter if it would be one state, two states, three states, no state. If people come with honesty, and this is something we learned outside of our region, that, you know, we went to South Africa, we went to the Balkans, we met a lot of people from both sides in North Ireland. They all say the same. Like you defined it or you described it, like it's madness, it's crazy, it's always looked like dark, that the sun will never shine, that it's a dead end and all these things. And all of a sudden, people said, we always believe in a solution. We always knew that the peace will come. We always knew that imbalance and injustices cannot survive and so on and so on. And we know that it will happen in the same way in our conflict, in our region. People will reach the solution. It doesn't matter, again, what the solution will be, one state, two state. When people will decide that enough is enough, we know that we can live together. We are an example. Combatants for Peace is an example. Despite the fact that the imbalance and the occupation and everything, within the movement, we are modeling a justice and equality and goodwill and a way to share the knowledge, to share the power, to share everything we can.
I just want to add just quickly that definitely one of our common enemies here, and there are a lot of community here, especially when we show our film in different for Palestinian or for Israelis, the common thing is like people lost hope, unfortunately, and people don't believe there is a partner on the other side. And the only meeting place between the two sides basically now is an army and a soldier and a weapon and all that. So for us as a grassroots movement, actually, we really struggle in order to legitimize the belonging of our people to this homeland. And we also support a moral and a just and nonviolent solution to the conflict. And mainly we would support the right of our people in both sides for self-determination. You know, I am a Palestinian. I never remember that anybody asked us what solution do we want, all the politicians and the negotiations. So that's really important to say that we recognize that each group here and everywhere have the right to decide their own solution. And definitely we will support a solution that based on moral values of justice and freedom and safety and dignity for the people on both sides. As Chen mentioned, you know, I was just watching a documentary about Berlin Wall. And that time I was in jail myself. I remember that nobody, a few days before the Berlin Wall fell, nobody talked about it, that this will happen. And, you know, in a minute, it changed the whole history and the whole world and United Germany. And so definitely our conflict is not a unique, though every people in any conflict, they believe this is their conflict is unique and it stay forever. So we carry a message of hope and action. And what somebody says, love and action. And that's what we do actually in our daily life, every day. This is like an everyday work on touching people's heart and open their eyes to see the other in between, to practice as a human and humanizing the other, because this is not obvious in any conflict.
You have both traveled extensively internationally, as you said, and you both are in touch with a lot of people in your place, in your country, in your villages and cities. Do you find attitudes changing both at home and abroad, in, for example, in the United States, but also in Israel?
Yeah, you know, often we are being blamed for preaching to the choir. I'm not interested in preaching to the choir, but I'm not interested in banging my head against the wall. I'm interested in enlarging the community of active people. So preaching to the choir is nothing for me. I'm talking about activating the choir instead of preaching to the choir. And I'm talking about expanding the community of active people. The fact that Combatants for Peace is in the world, in our reality for 12 years, it means that each and every Israeli or Palestinian who want to go with us, to walk with us, to march with us in this path with two lanes. One is the dialogue and the reconciliation, and the other is nonviolent resistance to the occupation. He or she knows who to join. So that's our role in the reality. So we feel that we are reaching a lot of people, maybe not the mass media and so on, but our community is expanding all the time.
Tell us about some of the projects that you're working on.
So I just want to say that, you know, Avner that you've seen in the film told me last year we did a celebration of 10 years of Combatants for Peace. And he reminded me after we screened the film at the wall in Beit Jala, hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians came and seen the film. We brought two ex-fighters, ex-combatants from Ireland, from the two sides of the story. and they spoke there. And Abner reminded me that when we started combatant service, it was really hard to speak about nonviolence. And now it's legitimate to a certain level, locally and internationally recognized. So I want to just mention that to start from home, that locally combatant service is widely known, and the idea of nonviolence and joint nonviolence. 2 weeks ago, we participated together with many other organizations, also Israelis and, of course, Palestinians, at Nabi Saleh to free Ahed Tamimi and the teenager prisoners and the young prisoners. And there were hundreds of people there, and totally combatant service was welcomed in that space. We also, internationally, I just want to mention that combatant service now is nominated for Nobel Peace Prize. So this is a really important recognition to legitimize our joint nonviolence struggle. And that's what maybe with our message. And personally, tomorrow I'm meeting 40 American Jewish educators. They are coming to Ramallah tomorrow. I'm spending my day with them, showing them around, and they will speak with a bunch of Palestinians and myself as well. I believe through the years, I can see that we are really changing hearts of many people, not just speaking, as Khin mentioned, to the people that agree with us. And actually, we invest a lot in speaking. Last year, I just want to give a number, 2017, we spoke to 3,000 people, not just me and Khin, other guys in combatant service, usually one Palestinian, one Israelis. We speak to everybody that willing to have a talk, and even the one that don't agree with us. And one example to give in that, we do the alternative, the Israeli-Palestinian Memorial Day. And this is very important because in Israel, they have the Memorial Day for the fallen soldiers. And in combatant service, we started together with the Family Forum, other organization, to remember the victims of the conflict together, to show empathy and to show there is a partner. And this event, 10 years ago, you would have 200 people, maybe 300 people. Last year, we have 5,000 people, actually, and this was all over the news. And after that, there was a demonstration against our event, the extreme right. And some of our team, some of our activists, they did meet with the people that demonstrate against us a month later to have a healthy discussion with them and to hear their criticism. So we do talk to all kinds of people that include. I have many of my own friends that were with me in jail. They don't agree with me and they still talk to me. Of course, not everybody in that. But definitely we, together with many other organizations locally, internationally, and in solidarity with each other, and which is challenging to bring all these organizations in one place, but we try always to work in alliances. 16th of March, we will have a big event in Jordan Valley. This is an area where the Israeli army don't let Palestinians to live freely in that area, like specifically and building settlements and annexing that area. We do that with alliances like Jordan Valley Coalition. And Samud, we did that with around 8 organizations. So we always try to expand our. We have also our own local community. We have Ramallah Tel Aviv group, Jericho Jerusalem group, Hebron Beersheba, and so on and so forth. We have a women group. And also we're establishing soon combatant service youth to do work with young Palestinian and young Israelis as well. So we do whatever we can, and we have to do more, actually, because we really see the change happening, like step by step.
Suleiman Khatib and Khin Alon are co-founders of Combatants for Peace. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.